From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll look at how the Republican National Convention played out in Milwaukee and the impact it might have on Wisconsin politics. Then we'll learn about a Wisconsin pastor once known as a militant anti-abortion activist, who's now recognized as a far-right thought leader.
He's very good at presenting a more palatable image that's less radical, that's more acceptable to a broader audience, and then really gets the core of what he wants when he's speaking to his congregation.
Plus, an RNC volunteer shares their experience from the convention.
It was a very interesting experience for me because I went to the training thinking that the training would be a very political event in itself, and it absolutely wasn't. It was just very calm. We're here to do a professional job. You're here to be nonpartisan.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. After years of planning and preparations, the RNC has come and gone from Milwaukee. Former President Donald Trump and his vice presidential pick, J.D. Vance, accepted their nominations from the Republican Party. So what does this all mean for Wisconsin politics, now that they've left the state? WUWM's Mayan Silver covers that in this week's Capitol Notes.
This is Capitol Notes from Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mayan Silver. We made it through the Republican National Convention. Professor Barry Burden was there and has some thoughts about the former president's 90-minute acceptance speech. Burden is a UW-Madison politics professor and is filling in for JR this week. Welcome, Professor Burden. Thanks for being here.
Good morning. Glad to be with you.
All right, so Republican now official nominee Donald Trump gave a 1.5-hour speech at the RNC. It was riddled with falsehoods. He said that, quote, under my presidency, we had the most secure border, when in fact, illegal immigration was higher than it was during both of Obama's terms. He said immigrants are, quote, coming from prisons, they're coming from jails, they're coming from mental institutions and insane asylums. And that's false. Over about 3 years, immigration officials arrested about 100,000 non-citizens with criminal convictions. He says crime is up. It's not. He exaggerated the cost increase of groceries, gas, and mortgage rates. He said people used COVID to cheat in the 2020 election, which is totally false. What's the effect now, Professor Burden, in 2024, of having a candidate who talks like this?
Well, I will say for the delegates who were in the convention hall with Donald Trump, none of those falsehoods mattered. They were hanging on his every word and really enraptured by him this week, especially after the assassination attempt. You know, those falsehoods mimicked what he did in the debate against President Biden a few weeks before, but that was not the story coming out of the debate. Most of the focus was on concerns about Biden's ability and his, you know, mental capacity heading into another term as president. It is just very much Trump's style to be loose with the facts, to exaggerate, to say things that are simply untrue. And if that resonates with his supporters and has not tripped him up very much. So I expect he will continue to follow that style as a candidate and if he's reelected as president.
Well, it's interesting to say that you say he'll continue to follow that style, because Trump claimed after surviving the assassination attempt about a week ago that he had thrown out his speech and would have a message of unity with a gentler tone. In fact, I talked to some Republicans at the convention who said they were expecting that gentler tone, a message of unity, but instead he redoubled the things he has said all along. What do you make of that?
Yeah, it was not a gentler tone. You know, the first 10 minutes of the speech or 15 minutes or so, he recounted what happened at the shooting, and that had a somber, quiet feel to it. But then the remaining hour was essentially the Trump we have all come to know, rambling off of the teleprompter speech that had been prepared. He was sort of riffing and repeating himself and just trying ideas out on the crowd, which is what he does at most rallies. It's mostly an unscripted, it was an unscripted presidency when he was in office, and it's an unscripted kind of campaign. You know, he has promised a number of times over the years to change his behavior. When he was coming into office in 2017, he said something to the effect of he was going to be such a a serious button-down president that it would be boring, that he would stop what he had been like on the campaign trail. And of course, that didn't happen. So one might think a near-death experience would really change a person. And he did seem to carry himself somewhat differently this past week. But his rhetorical style and his disregard for the facts, I think, is going to be unchanged.
Well, other big news that came out of the convention, which was his vice president pick announcement of J.D. Vance. You, Professor Burden, were a first-generation college student before you became a professor. And like Vance, you're from Ohio. You tweeted, "I also grew up in a broken household in rural Ohio and was a cultural misfit when I arrived on an Ivy League campus." What do you think about Vance and what he brings to the GOP ticket?
Well, I think he cements the MAGA style of Republican politics. He is a populist. He, like Trump, rejects the old Republican idea of free-flowing trade and movement of people and capital across borders. You know, they're together. They're very much opposed to increasing immigration, allowing immigration. They're going to be working to deport probably millions of undocumented immigrants who are in the United States. They're both supportive of tariffs and other trade barriers to protect American producers. So that's, I think, a rejection of the kind of Reagan-Bush orthodoxy of the Republican Party. Vance is also someone who initially was a never-Trumper and said some pretty harsh things about Trump, I think calling him Hitler and other things back in 2016, but has completely come around. Was endorsed by Trump in his Senate race just 2 years ago, has made trips to Mar-a-Lago, made trips to Manhattan to sit in the courtroom with Trump during his hush money trial. So I think Trump really appreciates that kind of loyalty. And the fact that Trump was able to bend Vance to his will makes probably Trump more confident that Vance will be a loyal vice president and not get in his way.
You're tuned into Capital Notes. I'm WEWM's Mayan Silver, speaking with Barry Burden, professor at UW-Madison. So we're talking about J.D. Vance. Was Vance fairly unknown, you think, in Wisconsin as a younger senator from Ohio? And how do you think he plays for Republican efforts to win Wisconsin?
Well, he's the least experienced of all the candidates that Trump was considering. The other governors and senators who were on the short list that were being kind of whispered about as potential picks, Vance has been in office only since he was elected in 2022, so it's about a year and a half in the U.S. Senate. He has no other government experience before that. But of course, Donald Trump had no government experience or military experience when he was elected president, so it's not essential. But it does mean that Vance has not been on the national scene for very long. He's probably better known as the author of his famous memoir, Hillbilly Elegy, and then the film on Netflix that was made from that. He's also a regular talk show participants. You might see him on cable news shows if you're watching TV in Wisconsin. He's been around as a speaker, so he's been visible in some other ways. I expect we will see him a lot in Wisconsin on the campaign trail this fall. You know, he was selected for many reasons, but one of the reasons was his ability potentially to connect with working class white voters in the Midwest. His personal story about growing up in Ohio and Kentucky, they hope will resonate with rural residents in places like Wisconsin and Michigan. So he may be here visiting our state just as much as Trump is this campaign season.
And with your somewhat similar personal history, do you have any insights about Vance, just the Ohio connection, the college connection, going to an Ivy League, after having had a fairly maybe more rural upbringing? What do you think about that?
Yeah, he and I do have a couple things in common. I think one is just the range of different cultural environments in which we have found ourselves. You know, he went from what he describes as a hillbilly upbringing, where people were, I think in his view, kind of loving but irresponsible and lawless at times and struggling with drugs and alcohol and other kinds of problems, to ending up as a law student at Yale in kind of a bastion of fellow elites and, people with real connections who live rather different lives. And then Vance ended up doing venture capital in California. So he was connected to Silicon Valley. He was in the entertainment industry writing his book and selling the rights to the movie. Now he's in government. So in a very short period of time. He's only in his 30s. He's going to be one of the youngest vice presidents ever. He has just stepped in a lot of different cultural environments, I think, and that makes him a really interesting character.
And you said he'll be one of the youngest vice presidential candidates ever, right?
That's right. And the age gap between Trump and Vance, I think, will be the greatest of any ticket in U.S. history. So there, you know, I think his age was also part of the appeal to Trump to try to push the party towards younger voters and to set up maybe a successor who would be of a different generation.
So we were talking a little bit about how Vance as a choice would play with voters in Wisconsin. Wiz Politics also reported about a Wisconsin GOP strategist, Keith Gilkes, who said that he worries about overconfidence after a convention. He pointed out 2008 when John McCain and Sarah Palin came out very happy from their convention and then lost amply to Barack Obama. Where are Republicans now, do you feel, in Wisconsin and nationally? Do you have any sense of the temperature check on that?
They are elated. They are jubilant. This was a successful convention, about as successful as you can imagine, extremely unified behind the party and just exhilarated by Trump. You know, he was already viewed as a hero to many Republicans after the assassination attempt. He was elevated this week to almost a kind of godlike character. There were a lot of religious images and references made at the convention. So the party is completely enthusiastic and also extremely confident about their chances. I heard Tucker Carlson, the former Fox News commentator, analyst, saying this week he thought Trump had locked up the race with the shooting and that it was not going to be a contest this fall. And at the moment, they certainly have a massive advantage in fundraising, all of those things that follow from that confidence. But I think it is something useful for a party to remember that things can change quickly. The election is still 3 to 4 months away. There will be probably another debate. The Democrats might choose another nominee or have a more interesting convention than they normally do if it's not clear that Biden is going to be the one who's selected. There could be a health incident. We've had an assassination attempt in the last week. So lots of things can happen between now and November that might shift the course of things. And Republicans would be wise to keep their foot on the pedal, to keep the funding coming in, to keep the activists and volunteers energized and working through Election Day. I heard a little of that messaging at the convention, but they're probably going to need more of it to really keep up the work right through the end of voting in November.
All right. Well, thanks so much for filling us in on all of this, Barry. And thank you for joining me on Capital Notes.
Glad to be with you.
You can hear Capital Notes every other week on Lake Effect and find it at WUWM.com. And while the RNC may be over, there is a partisan primary election coming up on August 13th. The following week is the DNC in Chicago. You can find more information about all of this on WUWM's Voter Guide. Milwaukee area pastor Matthew Truella once had a reputation for being one of the nation's most militant anti-abortion activists. He called for churches to form militias, signed documents saying the murder of abortion providers is justifiable, and frequently blockaded women's clinics. Today, he's a far-right thought leader who's influencing politics from the local to national level. Wisconsin Watch reporter Phoebe Petrovic looked into this Wisconsin man's story and the impact for ProPublica. She joins Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski.
First known as a militant anti-abortion activist, what other key stances has he made a career with?
So his biggest ones are anti-abortion, pro-gun rights, and anti-gay rights. Those have been sort of the main talking points as far back as the 90s. He was kind of infamous in 1999, a couple months after the Columbine high school mass shooting, which was kind of one of the first ones that we really think about. Of course, it wasn't actually the first. But a couple months later, he was outside of the Waukesha High School handing out flyers that said, "Never disarm." Some of these flyers were in the shape of bullets. And that was the sort of thing that people in the community were kind of in a tizzy about. And he, you know, has consistently been against same-sex marriage and gay rights, often referring to all of that as the quote-unquote filth of sodomy.
So one thing you mentioned is something called the Doctrine of the Lesser Magistrates. And as you said, it was his book in 2013 that was first published. But this phrase and this idea of the lesser magistrates has still persisted and grown even more today. So how do we see this phrase in the doctrine sneak its way elsewhere into more modern, you know, whether it's speeches, vernacular, actual legislation, laws?
Yeah, so we found it all over the place. We found that Torella had been sort of banging this drum since 2013, but it really exploded during the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic, when people were looking for a way to resist public health measures like school masking or restaurants closing, things like that. So we found it popping up in local meetings in Indiana and Tennessee. Andy Ogles, who was then the mayor of Maury County, Tennessee, mayor is, you know, the chief executive, and he is now a congressman. Andy Ogles invoked the doctrine when he issued an emergency order that would allow unvaccinated healthcare workers to keep their jobs. We found this popping up in relation to so-called abortion abolition bills, which seek to completely outlaw abortion and also in some cases impose criminal penalties on people who obtain abortions in relation to Second Amendment sanctuary resolutions. And we found this, you know, I found school board members who were citing this, county commissioners, state lawmakers, governors, all the way up to former members of the Trump administration or Trump allies. So it really kind of spans the gamut.
With such a wide span, he does have Milwaukee area roots. What is Truella's relationship to local Wisconsin Republican individuals or organizations at large?
Yeah. So I actually just got off the phone with a member of his church who is the chair of the Fond du Lac County Republican Party. And that's not even in the story. But he was very clear that Pastor Matt had influenced his thinking a lot and actually gave him the blessing to run for the chair position in Fond du Lac. The other really big one in Wisconsin is the Waukesha County Republican Party. So they have invited Torella to speak twice. The first was to local candidates. He was sharing his doctrine to people who would then go on to run for school board or county commission or things like that. And Waukesha County Republican Party has Torella's book on their website. It's, from what I can tell, the only book that is promoted on their website with a whole page dedicated to it. They sell it in the office. And they have other ties to him as well. But this one was really significant to us because Waukesha is kind of the heart of Republican politics in Wisconsin. It's really kind of as mainstream as you can get, most reliably read, turning out a huge number of votes for the Republican side. And so the fact that Waukesha, which is kind of nationally known, right, as an important place in electoral politics, the fact that they have this relationship to Torella and are promoting this doctrine that is like explicitly theocratic, saying that you can defy laws if they don't comport with God's law, you know, that's really striking.
So I want to talk about that kind of, not a juxtaposition necessarily, but who he is at his church while giving sermons, and then his demeanor that's described when he's publicly facing, you know, he's involved in politics, yet he doesn't believe women should hold political office. So what are some of the dynamics at play here of when he's being put in front of a public-facing event with political affiliates versus when he's preaching?
That distinction was one of the most interesting that I found that I really wanted to highlight for people who are only aware of his more public-facing presentation. So Torella, like anyone, modulates how he presents himself, and he's really skilled and adept at presenting someone who is calm, congenial, very affable, makes a lot of jokes, you know, waters down the radicalism of his message when he's speaking to more public-facing groups. One of the most striking things we noticed was that he's friendly and affable, shaking hands with the women who are in elected party office or hold like elected public office. And then he in church on Sundays is preaching to his congregation about how women in government is sickening and perverse, almost as perverse as sitting under a female pastor. And it's a sign of God's judgment upon the nation. He, you know, has spoken at some events about how he does not support LGBTQ rights, but then at his congregation, he's telling them that this is a crime under God's law that deserves the death penalty. So it is a quite an extreme departure. So he's very good at presenting a more palatable image that's less radical, that's more acceptable to a broader audience. And then it seems really gets the core of what he wants when he's speaking to his congregation.
Right. There was a lot of work that you put into this article, including an initial interview with Truala. So can you share what that was like as we're talking about kind of the changes in his demeanor and how he can present himself in different ways?
Yeah. So I was a lot of planning went into that initial interview, because when we had first started reporting, I sent out a bunch of public records requests. Somehow Truala got a copy of that and then blasted that over his Facebook and his emails newsletter saying, quote unquote, the wicked are trembling. And so I was prepared for him to be not thrilled to see me, but he was perfectly polite. A lot of the things he said were the same things that I'd heard again and again. You know, he's got familiar talking points. But other than initially turning to my male colleague and introducing himself to that person first, even though he was kind of stepping back and letting me do the interview, Pastor Trell was very polite, happy to talk, very engaged with what he's doing. And, you know, we kind of hit on some of the basics, tried to keep it light in hopes that we would be able to have a second interview with him. At the end, we did ask him, in the 90s, you were seen as a really extreme figure, including by mainstream Republicans, and you've made this turnabout. How did that happen? What do you have to say about people who called you extreme? And he said, you know, it's quoted in the story, but kind of laughed at that and said, you know, basically, people call me an extremist because they are self-centered and I care about the issue of abortion. And we, you know, tried to set up another time to speak and left him over a dozen calls and voicemails and text messages and emails. And he did not get back to us. So we sent him written questions by certified mail and he declined receipt.
Is Truala like kind of a prime example of this parallel of how local movements kind of behind the scene operations can have a larger impact without people necessarily knowing the scale of it?
I think so. That's certainly what the researchers that I spoke to, the extremism researchers, said, that he was a great lens through which to view this moment and what happens. You know, he's not the only one influencing politics by any means, but he's a particularly interesting one who is really, as they said, kind of a thought leader on the far right, kind of someone who's creating the intellectual and religious justification for some of these far right policies that then is getting kind of translated and modulated and disseminated. And so, you know, there were people who we spoke to, for example, in various counties across the country who had passed Second Amendment sanctuary resolutions that included this lesser magistrate language, that we could trace back to someone who passed this resolution saying specifically that Truala's book had influenced them. But then by the time it got to like the sixth county, they were just copying the language, right? And didn't know where it came from. And so one of the things we were hoping to do is kind of excavate those links for people so they could really understand what was going on and what ideas were driving the conversation.
Definitely. And as this is ongoing, hopefully we can have you back to learn more. But for today, Phoebe, I want to thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Phoebe Petrovic is an investigative reporter at Wisconsin Watch and a ProPublica Local Reporting Network fellow. At WUWM.com, you can find her full article called The Gospel of Matthew Truala: How a Militant Anti-Abortion Activist is Influencing Republican Politics. Petrovic spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski. In about 10 minutes, we'll hear from two senior dance groups about how dancing does more than just keep them healthy. But first, we'll hear from a Milwaukee man who volunteered at last week's RNC. That's coming up next on Lake Effect. on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Thousands of volunteers were needed to pull off last week's Republican National Convention. One of those volunteers was David Stack. He's a Milwaukee man who says he leans Democrat. He tells WUWM Susan Bentz he wanted to connect with the delegates and attendees as human beings, so he decided to volunteer at the event. He shares what that experience was like.
When I realized it was going to be in Milwaukee and that they were going to have a call for volunteers, the thought of, well, we can help Milwaukee and Southeast Wisconsin sort of put its best foot forward. Here we are. We're kind of on the national stage. Also, with all the hoopla and consternation that have been around the elections the last couple cycles, you know, I think I'm very interested. It's like, let's help work the process the way the process is designed to work. You know, where we have conventions and we nominate candidates, and let's just make sure that all goes smoothly and above board. So even though, of course, I wouldn't be directly part of that, just wanted to make sure that process came off well.
So have you been involved in the workings of elections in previous years, whether local, state, or national?
No, I've never done anything that. I've known a lot of people that volunteer at the polls or that kind of thing, and always sort of thought about that a little bit, But no, I haven't done anything before this.
So you volunteered directly through the RNC, or was it a Visit Milwaukee connection?
They had representatives from both involved. This was an RNC event. Yeah.
And what was the process of your volunteering, of, you know, saying, I'd like to volunteer?
Yeah, I think filling out some kind of an online form, and then they get back in touch with you, and you go through a Secret Service background check. And they had a training day, or a couple hours for everyone, and then show up at your assignments.
What was involved in the training, and were there bunches of people there?
It was a very interesting experience for me, because I went to the training thinking, I'm just going to see all of, you know, all these T-shirts and hats and everything with all these slogans on them, and, you know, this that the training would be a very political event in itself, and it absolutely wasn't. It was very calm. It was, you know, it was conducted by the RNC. It was just very calm. We're here to do a professional job. You're here to be nonpartisan. And the people there were, by and large, they were people like me. I mean, there's, you know, who's can do this in the middle of the day? Either people who take off of work or retired people. So mostly retired people who just seemed to be very intent on doing a good job and doing the right thing.
And was safety the primary, you know, what was the message beyond being nonpartisan?
To be welcoming to people and to, you know, try and support their experience, and for safety concerns, they said, you know, this will be the safest place in Wisconsin during the convention because of so many law enforcement being around. So, you know, and it was true during the convention. I mean, you know, you're almost always within 10 feet of some kind of a law enforcement.
What was your assignment?
I had an assignment at a hotel out in Waukesha to greet people on Sunday before the convention started. There were not many people staying at this hotel. There were four of us volunteers, not really knowing what to do except say hello as people came in the door, and we did that. And then on Monday, I and the other volunteers for that shift were in the security zone, and as people came through the magnet detectors, we directed them to where they needed to go, which we didn't know any as we got on assignment. We didn't know the layout of the place, so we learned it as we did it.
Did you have any conversations with people that stick with you?
I had lots of time to talk with the other volunteers because we reported to our shift early and people didn't start coming till almost noon. What struck me was, because I presume that I was probably the only person I was talking with who, you know, doesn't regularly vote Republican, was how people seemed, the other volunteers, seemed to be actually hurt by rhetoric around, you know, that Trump is a fascist or Republicans are a fascist. That word seemed to, I mean, I thought they felt hurt. That really stung.
So you mentioned you're not a person who would regularly vote Republican. Have you gone back and forth in your voting history?
I've gone back and forth, although I think mostly vote Democratic, but I always look. You know, I feel like my conservative friends would think I'm a liberal and my liberal friends think I'm a conservative, so.
Have your, and by interests I mean what you hope will come through this next election cycle, have those evolved over the months and year possibly? Or, you know, what are you most concerned about, interested in seeing happen in our country?
Well, I've been concerned about rhetoric about that those who have resisted the comeback of former President Trump need to be punished, that the people who've been involved with bringing the lawsuits or the other proceedings and stuff like that, that these people are deserving of punishment, or that also that concerns that those who speak out or who cover things in the media, you know, might get throttled. Like, we don't want to hear bad news. We want to hear just the party news. So I'm concerned about those kinds of things. I'm very concerned about those kinds of things. I didn't hear any of that in...
On the street?
On the street or in the former president's acceptance speech. But I'm very worried about both of those.
So it's a challenging situation. You mentioned earlier as we began to speak that it's important to you that our country and our system function as it was designed to, meaning we elect people. We, you know, we support them. We let the process work as it's supposed to work. So do you think we're in a position now that can happen?
I would hope so. I mean, so far going into this election cycle, it looks like things are on track, you know, and I guess it depends on the outcomes, and it depends whether people accept or not accept those outcomes. And it's scary to me if we have elections and then question them to such a degree that it's like, why did we bother?
You said this is the first time that you volunteered for any kind of event of this kind. Do you think you'll do it again? Do you think there's a next step in your volunteer career?
Well, I like large immersive events, and I figured this was going to be a very large 50,000 person immersive event down at the Pfizer Forum. So, and it was that. So I like that. So as far as politically, I don't know. I do wonder if things would take a bad turn, maybe I'd be out on the streets protesting. So, you know, I hope that doesn't happen.
Having had this experience in volunteering for the RNC, has that altered your concerns about what's to come?
Well, I felt very good about the volunteers in general. I mean, you know, when we were marshaled in groups of hundreds of people and then split down into our different assignments, you know, and I felt very good about them as people. And that was kind of my goal. It's like, okay, you know, if you just get stuff from the news and everything, then you tend to think of people as other. They're other than me. And no, by going there and seeing that, hey, these are people just like me, they, you know, and boy, they feel really hurt by the way they've been characterized and stuff. So I felt very, very good about, you know, the actual people. And I felt very good about the process, that the process for bringing on the volunteers was like, hey, you're here to do a professional job. You're not here to advance the political goals of the party.
David Stack is a Milwaukee resident who volunteered at last week's RNC. He spoke with WUWM's Susan Bentz. If the RNC and current state of politics has left you feeling a little checked out, trust me, the next story will help.
That's the legacy that we want to leave, that when you become a senior, life is just beginning. We're living our best lives right now.
We'll hear from some seniors who dance next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. A single session of physical activity can have immediate and long-term health benefits for seniors. It helps improve brain health, heart health, and improves bone strength. There are a lot of ways for seniors to be safely active, but one of the best ways to stay healthy, happy, and find a sense of community is through dance. And let's face it, dancing is just fun, no matter what your age. Lake Effect's Jimmy Gutierrez met with two senior dance groups. One is at Oasis, a 50-plus center on the south side that offers year-round classes, including different workout groups. But we'll start at Clinton Rose Senior Center with the Rose Letts, a dance group that's been stepping for over 30 years, staying healthy and supporting each other.
Here during our break, I'm going to call on some people just to talk and tell why you involved with the Rosalettes. And I'm so glad that our original Rosalette got in the house. Yeah. Lucille Cole, who's been with the Rosalettes since 1991.
My name is Lucille Cole, and I came to the Clinton Rose Center. My husband had passed. So it started out at an exercise group where we were had so much energy till the president organized, Fanny Dunlop, she organized this group from the exercise group because we did exercise, you know, but not the old folks exercise. So I just enjoyed it. I just been here. It was since 91.
My name is Brenda Porter.
My name is Arcola Edwards, and I'm currently the president of the Rosalette Dancers.
I joined in 02. I've been retired 25 years, okay. And I got both knees replaced and both hips.
And you're still going.
So still going.
Hi, my name is Vanessa Bryce, and I started with the Rosalettes the last of August of 2023.
Can you introduce yourself and tell me how long you've been with the Rosalettes?
My name is Lois Reddick, and I've been with the Rosalettes since September of 2003. In fact, I celebrated 20 years of retirement last year and 20 years with the Rosalettes.
What is the group given to you personally?
Stardom. I'm a star as a Rosalette dancer. I laugh about that, you know, but I think people got to know me as a Rosalette dancer. And for sure, coming in here has helped my health and mental state.
It keeps you agile, keeps you moving, keeps your bones moving. You don't get stiff. And I enjoy that. I don't want to get stiff. Where I can't get up, I have to be on a walker or can't move around like I want to. I like to be able to take care of myself for as long as I can. I don't want nobody to help me.
You know, instead of just standing in a house all day being depressed, you know, you come out, you dance, it's something called enjoyment, and I love it.
I had a heart condition. The doctor told me, he said, you can't dance. And I just broke down in the doctor's office and cried. Now, I didn't tell my husband, but I told Lois, who was then the dance instructor, my situation. So what I did is I told her, I said, place me on the end, and I'm just going to do one dance. And that's how I handled that situation. So that problem has been corrected, and I've been dancing ever since.
Go ahead, Arcola.
What do these girls or these women or these sister dancers mean to you, and how have they shown up for you over the years?
Well, You know, if you live long enough, you have sicknesses and you have deaths. And it's always nice to know people are thinking about you. This time, last year, my voice had messed up. I had a thyroid that was, it was pressing up against my voice box. And I didn't even now know whether after surgery I was going to be able to talk. But through it all, I didn't give up, and they didn't give up on me. People helped with the directions, giving the directions of the dance. That's what comes from being with people two times a week, 3 hours a week, you know. You get to know each other, and it's some love starts to happen.
There's another dancer, and she and I both went through I lost my husband, and she lost a family member. So we, both of us either lost two or three family members last year, and we've been a support to each other. Had my husband lived, we would have been married 50 years this past February. So that's a big change in my life. So just having people you can share things with, but not necessarily the entire dance group. All of us have one individual that we're closest to.
You know, we always try to make sure everybody get what they need. If you sick, let us know. We get together and we bring stuff to you, whether it's food, fruit, car, just a conversation.
All right, we got a new dance in the house, y'all.
All right now, Jimmy.
I'll be sure to show no one that.
I'm on oxygen, and I forgot my... You don't have a tube with you, do you?
I do not. No. No, I don't.
I don't have an oxygen tube.
Oh, I forgot.
What do you think the legacy is of the Roselots?
You got some senior women that know how to have a good time. You know, they smiling through it all. When we're out in front of people performing, they don't know about our aches and pains. They don't know about even the disagreements that we have had in getting this routine together. They see the final product, and the final product, we got smiles on our faces, our bodies are moving, our hips are shaking, and we're just having a good time.
We used to go into the nursing homes and perform and then interact with them as we got through performing. I love that.
Why did you love that?
Because they wasn't able to. Some of them couldn't walk or something. And it just did my heart good because they enjoyed us so much. They really enjoyed us. And that made me happy.
We were founded by Miss Fanny Dunlap. And I met her in 2010. And she asked me and another then dancer who since moved out of state to make sure that the Roselets stay together. And that's what I've been doing since 2010, keeping this group together.
I hope that the group goes on and on because it's really something that gets you out of the house and keeps you busy and it's like fellowship with all the girl ladies. We're like friends. We're not, you know, not just dance person. We get to know each other. When we're out doing things in the community, they are saying to us, ooh, when I grow up, I want to be just like you, you know? And we clapping our hands and saying, yeah, well, we trying to set a good example. So that's the legacy that we want to leave, that when you become a senior, life is just beginning. We're living our best lives right now.
All right.
The Roselots show no sign of slowing down and even let me know before I left that they perform at birthday parties and get-togethers. They call themselves, unsurprisingly, the life of the party. On the south side of the city, there is another place for older adult dancing and community. Oasis is on 24th and Mitchell and is run by Milwaukee Rec. And like Clinton Rose, it is more than just a building.
more than its programming, although there is a lot of programming. Urban gardening, fine arts classes, a rec and workout room, ESL classes. It seems like the longer I was there, the more classes were being added. I talked with Megan Fry, who kind of runs things around the center, and she told me that the first stop I should go and check out was their Zumba Gold class, senior Zumba. But I had a few questions for her first. This is Wisconsin, where we do not have great weather all the time. This is Wisconsin, where we have a drinking history and drinking culture. This is Wisconsin, where we have a very graying population that doesn't have a history of staying active or getting active. So what is the importance of that?
So to me, I mean, I think about my childhood and, you know, I played sports my whole life and that was an opportunity for me. And that's something I'll continue to do for my whole life because I have that already. There's certainly exceptions to this, but I can speak for my parents. They didn't play sports. I think my dad swam, but sports just weren't quite as commonly played back in the population that we're talking about when they were younger. Most of the people that come in here are just trying to make sure that their body ages well. You know, as we get older and the fear of dementia, the fear of cardiovascular disease, the fear of these things that really are common as we get older, especially, that's ultimately for the most part why people enter our doors. But I think we just see this as an opportunity to focus on whole wellness for every individual that walks in here. And if we have to tweak a little something, we are a small enough center that we can make something work.
I mean, a personal question that I have for you is, because you've been doing this for a while, so I'm guessing that it means something to you. So what kind of like pulled you to this kind of work and what kind of have you seen throughout your time here that's like, oh, this is important work that I am kind of like involved in?
Sure. Yeah. So like I said, I was working with the adult sports population and I was getting a little burned out. A lot of late nights, a lot of moaning and groaning here and there. And so I was doing that for 8 years and loving it. And I knew I wanted to stay here, but I think I just needed a little bit of a change. And this position opened up and I've fallen in love with it. I feel like I'm working with my mom and dad every day, which has been really special for me as I get older. I'm really only 9 years away from being able to take advantage of the programming here since it's a 50-plus center. And so I see my parents, I see my grandparents, and I see myself in this work. I think COVID put us in a place where it's important to have physical fitness and emotional fitness and all of these things that make us well. But that social aspect COVID took away for so long. And really, like, if you ask me what my main goal is, it's to have people be surrounded by others and have those support systems. And for most people that come in here, they have a friend group and it's a group that they don't just see here. They see outside of our building, and they have lifelong friendships now that they've built.
That's the way. I like it.
Okay, this is choreographed. They've done this before. In class today, there were close to a dozen seniors, some from the neighborhood, others from all over Milwaukee. And something they all said was that they would follow their instructor, Ava, wherever she goes. I feel like these are your children almost, like how much they adore you and love you and come to follow you. It sounds like, how long have you been doing this and why do you keep coming back?
Maybe more than 10 years. And especially I feel very comfortable in this is my home. I feel this is my family. And then I start having, you know, diabetes. So this has helped me more than they gave me more. Than I can offer, you know?
I'm looking at seniors staying healthy. You know, as you age, it's so important to keep working out, to stay strong, to keep using your body. Can you talk a little bit about why it's so important for as you age to use your body and to stay in shape?
Sure. This age, we have losing cells. Since you are 24, you start losing your brain cells. So you have to make more, no? Like your body exercise. If you don't move it, you lose it. You know, we're trying to do tiny at the beginning and then, you know, a little bit more, a little bit more. And they are very proud because they are learning something and their brain is working, their memory is working. And especially because we have dementia cases, or, you know, they lose their memory, or they lose their, I don't know, mobility. They come to surgeries. So it's come a really, really hard time for us to keep on the day in the day. If they stay at home, they're going to be depressed. I invite everybody to try, you know, to find a family anywhere, any place. But this is the best. We invite everybody if we want to keep going.
Support each other through thick and thin. Buying houses, buying cars, who knows?
We celebrate birthdays.
Today is his birthday.
And it's Ava's wedding anniversary today.
The group ranges in how long people have been coming. Some have been coming 10 to 15 years. Others just got started this year with the New Year's resolution. And they all had different reasons for coming.
I hope I would be inspirational, because I also share mine on my Facebook and other social media, because I literally came to lose my COVID-19 pounds that I gained during the pandemic. And so I literally just came to lose my 19 pounds. I've already lost 10 of them since January, and I'm certain the next 9 are on the way.
We're not the only ones that take just this class. There's other classes that we teach here. Ava teaches Spanish and drum. There's opportunities.
We go to strength classes and core classes. The people, the instructors, are what encourage us. They tell us to do what we can, when we can. We have to sit down. But it's helped me, because this is the time when I really need to do something about myself.
It feels more than an exercise group. It feels kind of like a family. Can you put your finger on and share a story of when this group supported you in a specific kind of way? And that's a question for everybody.
I don't know if I can. I lost both my brother. 2 weeks later, lost my brother-in-law. 3 months later, I lost my sister-in-law, who was married to my brother. And then a year later, I lost my precious dog that I had for 16 years and 6 months, my Rosie. So it was the ability to come here and work through that grief and to have that support and to have that love was really important and kind of carried me through that. So I appreciated that very much.
I've gone through a lot. Broke my finger once, and they were all in support of that.
I just want to say that you broke your middle finger. That you just, you just kind of flipped me off. It's okay. I broke this finger.
What is the middle finger? But I also went through some problems with my breathing and things like that. And I've been going through. I had a cardiac catheterization not too long ago, but everyone was always asking me when I came back and. Glad you're back, and how are you? And I'm still going through a couple things, but they're a great group.
Like Megan said earlier, through the places I've visited, I see my family in these rooms, the best versions of them, aging and staying healthy, aging and still thrusting their hips, aging with friends, and still living their best lives.
That was Lake Effect's Jimmy Gutierrez. He spoke with the Roselets at Clinton Rose Senior Center and members of Oasis Zumba Gold class. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of today's conversations, or if you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, Chirp Chat takes you inside the International Crane Foundation in Baraboo. Plus, we'll help you plan a one-of-a-kind Wisconsin camping trip in Wandering Wisconsin. That's all tomorrow at noon, right here on Lake Effect, on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.